This is the third day of our seven-day retreat here at Southern Dharma. You're still planning the... Do you think this is the day for it?
Bright and sunny, make change.
So, do you want to plan on it? I mean, so I know when to stop. Or else you know I could just... Let's do the null. All right, so we'll stop at 4:15. So, again, this is the third day. And again, we are following a tradition that, at least in the Buddhist tradition, we could say goes back to the Buddha, but that's not the only tradition in which seekers, finders, people of the way, gather together, like we are doing today. Putting aside their normal duties, responsibilities, activities, and coming together in some place of solitude to devote themselves to just what we're doing. Listening to teachings, practicing the teachings, enjoying fellowship, fellow seekers. So this is ancient stuff. But it's wonderful, and it should be really part of, but anyhow, how nice it would be if this was part of everyone's life. Obviously, as lay people, we certainly, we have families, we have responsibilities, and we have our involvements with our community. And so therefore, that takes up time. But it's good to balance that with taking time away where we can just be and where we can accelerate our ripening. It doesn't mean that in the midst of daily life and activities we cannot make wonderful progress on the way, but in a certain way it is more difficult because there's less nutriment, less nurturance, less support from the activities around us and the people around us constantly reminding us to wake up. Right? Unfortunately, the world's message is often, please stay asleep with me in this common delusion that we share. Right? And you know, oftentimes, it's like you know, the alcoholic or the drug addict. You know, when they tell their buddies down at the corner bar that they're going to give up drinking, one, people are incredulous, and two, they say, no, stay with us. This is the good way. This is the way to live, right? Don't leave us. Don't be a fool. Right? And so in the same way, for many of us, when we kind of share a need or desire to break out of the common delusion and the shared values of often a valueless society, and look for meaning and truth and substance. Again, often we do not get much support or encouragement, because also in the world, melodrama rules. And most of our involvement with people is often sharing melodrama and drama. And when all of a sudden finds that way of living no longer meaningful, and also just a source of ongoing suffering and foolishness. Again, we are leaving kind of a shared experience, because most people are totally involved in the melodrama, live for the melodrama, and define themselves in terms of how the melodrama is going. And that is just, do not think that our society is exceptional. It is only exceptional. It has harnessed the creative mind to find endless ways of keeping the shared delusion going in more and more interesting, stimulating, fascinating, faster, quicker, more enticing and seducing ways than perhaps at the Buddha's time. But other than that, nothing's really changed much. Sentient beings are still up to their old tricks. Trying to find meaning where there's no meaning. Trying to find happiness in a way that essentially produces dissatisfaction. And going about, just as it said in the sutra, everything is topsy-turvy. Everything is topsy-turvy, everything is upside down. Sort of like Alice falling down the rabbit's hole. Encouraging that strange world where everything seems to be backwards. I think that's the way the Buddha and the masters look at our world. But yet you see, after kind of probably initially like Alice trying to wonder, you know, what the hell's going on here? Who are these people? What are they up to? You know, they all seem so crazy, right? Mad hatters, and raging queens, and, you know, all that stuff. People's heads being lopped off for no reason. But again, these teachings that we're finding here in this sutra, and we find in other Buddhist teachings, actually show us how to live a meaningful, purposeful, awakened, happy life in the midst of this topsy-turvy, totally turned around backwards world. And so that's why these teachings are very precious, rare and precious, and we are fortunate that we have opportunities that they still exist, they're still being taught, and we are shown, most importantly, how to practice them. Because this, as you see, the thrust of this is always the Bodhisattva, right? Which means we are all the hearers, those who are hearing these teachings. We are encouraged to also trod this way in this life, and to take up the Bodhisattva's work wherever we are, of working to alleviate the suffering of people in this topsy-turvy world and help them to turn their minds around so they can see clearly. So the self-induced, self-created, communally created suffering can end. And again, that may sound somewhat idealistic, but again, if one human being such as us, each of us, if we can turn around our topsy-turviness, if we can begin to see with greater clarity what's really going on, and if we can rid ourselves of all our own hindrances and defilements that prevent us from functioning as a loving, caring, intelligent, wise, selfless human being in this world. If we can do it, that means everyone has the potential for doing it. There is nothing unique about any of us. So again, 25 people here, 27 people here, 30 people here. As we over time cultivate this way, we will, all of us, have that capability of being a participant in this tradition that goes back to the time of the Buddha. To be people who both not only wield the lotus of compassion and love, but also wield the sword of insight and wisdom. Two hands of the Bodhisattva. And so anyhow. And so let us see what these two guys are up to. And again, I'm skipping a little bit, but not too much. So then Manjusri asked Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva go about comforting and instructing another bodhisattva who is ill? So this is practical stuff. Because all of us will be encountering many, many other people who are ill. All of us have that opportunity in our life. Again, of course, he's saying here another bodhisattva. So I think very directly we're saying, how do I respond to when someone else is on the path? How do I deal with them, talk with them when they're ill? So Vimalakirti replies, tell her about the impermanence of the body, but do not tell her to despise or turn away from the body. So in other types of teachings within Buddhism, in what the Mahayana is called the Hinayana, which just really means a path that is more based on renunciation, in which there is clean and dirty, very strong, right and wrong, pure, impure. And in those teachings, the body is very impure. The body is disgusting, and there are lots of meditations to help one develop an aversion for the body. But it's not the Mahayana way. So, what he's saying, at the same time you are talking about that this body is subject to change, it is subject to falling apart, which getting sick really is just a kind of falling apart in preparation for the big falling apart. But at the same time, don't do that in a way that the person has revulsion for their body or looks upon their body as their enemy or something foreign or something to despise or something to be disgusted about or something to be disinterested in. This is very important, because the Bodhisattva way, the Mahayana way, is always about understanding. It's not about rejection. It's not about right and wrong, and it's complex, but it's very simple. So the liberation comes from understanding. Understand the nature of the body, but do not despise it or turn away from the body, which implies what? I mean, the positive way of saying that is what? Love your body. Accept your body. Love your body. Take care of your body. Do not feel that taking care of your body, which means, all the stuff we always hear about, make sure you got a good night's sleep, make sure you got a good enough rest, eat nutritious food, make sure you get enough exercise, right? Movement, that's all important for practitioners. Because our body is our vehicle in this life for everything we do. So we want to have healthy bodies to our best well-being. Why? So we can carry on our task as bodhisattvas. Because everybody else, as you look around in this realm, seems to incarnate in bodies. And we seem to relate to each other in bodies. So in that case, we need to hold on to ours as long as we can. Not again because of any narcissistic, obsessive kind of attachment to our body, to our health, to our energy, all the obsessive kind of things that is so stridently marketed these days to make people always kind of pumping their bodies up in endless different ways. It's not like that. That's obsessive attachment. But this is just more, it's easy, more easygoing. Right? Understand the body as a vehicle, and take good care of it, which also means don't do any harm to it consciously. So don't put toxins in it. Don't eat foods that are not good for your body. Don't eat foods in amounts that create stress and strain on your body, on your heart, like that. Tell her about the impermanence of the body, but tell him or her not to despise it or turn away. Tell him about the sufferings of the body, but do not tell him to strive for nirvana. Now again, this is referring to that more Hinayana practice, samsara, there's samsara over here and nirvana over here. Like these are two geographic lands, sort of like heaven and hell or something. You know, it's like that, you know. So he's saying at the same time that you talk to them about the normality, and you know, earlier on, Vimalakirti enumerates how the body is a magnet for suffering. And, we know that. I mean, how many people here, since they've been here, have experienced bodily suffering? I mean, right? So let me ask you, is bodily suffering normal or abnormal? Right? Can you see, but yet we... just given a little exclamation point for human suffering. So, I mean, right? So each of us might be in our own individual suffering going, oh, why is this happening to me? Or it shouldn't be happening to me? Or why only me? You know how we get into that? And yet we look around, we go, oh, everybody is suffering something. Right? So what does that tell you? The body is a magnet for suffering. Right? I hurt my knee just walking up the hill. Right? Just very much enjoying it. Took a bad step. And right? It's like that, isn't it? Right? We're just going about our normal business, naive as we are, right, enjoying our life. And the body just attracts suffering. Just the way it is. But do not... Do not tell him to strive for nirvana, which means do not strive, do not tell him that there's a heavenly pure land somewhere else, and in that, bodies are indestructible and they never get sick, and if you practice hard, you will be reborn in that pure land and never be ill again. Right? The suffering is only temporary. Like that. This is not the bodhisattva practice. The practice is, yes, to have a body is to have suffering. But we're all in this together. Right? And do not think about leaving, because you are needed here. You are needed here to help all the other people who are suffering. We all take care of each other. You know that, what's that? You know that thing about hell, what's that? Where it's, you know, hell is like there, you haven't thought about this in a while. You know, hell is, it's like you go into this room and there is this there's this table just laden with food, but everybody has these long arms that don't bend, and so they can grab the food, but they can't get it to their mouth. Right? So that's hell. And then, so somebody might say, "Well, then, what's heaven?" And they said, there's a room, and there's a table laden with food, and everybody has these long arms that can't bend, and they're grabbing the food, and then they're reaching over and feeding the person next to them. It's like that. Tell her that the body is without ego, but urge her to teach and guide living beings. So what you're finding here is the practical application of the Heart Sutra, right? It's telling us, do not, or what's in Buddhism is called Majjhimika, which means you don't go to either extreme. At the one hand, you tell them there is no inherent self, no ego in the body. The body is without ego. It is just made up of causes and conditions and variables. There is nothing there. But at the same time, right, have the desire. Right? Because one could go, well, there's no ego here, there's no ego there. You know, so why do anything, right? No need to do anything. And you see the extreme that one can fall in. But it's saying, no, it's not like that. Even though there is inherently no self, it doesn't mean that the interdependence and commonality of all life doesn't exist and one cannot be aware of the suffering of others and be of help. Right? So it's warning us to say, just because one has seen inherently into the non-self nature of reality does not negate the world of activity, the world of compassionate action. Right? And again, you see there are some traditions which sort of have that view. Oh, everything is empty, everything is one. So there's really nothing to do. Everything is just perfect as it is. So there's no need to do anything. And the teaching here is don't go to that extreme. That's a lopsided view. At the deepest level, there is no self, there is no suffering. And yet at the relative level, there is suffering, isn't there? It's the other side of the coin. Tell him to repent of former offenses, but do not tell him to consign them to the past. That's an interesting line. I'm not exactly sure what Vimalakirti is saying. So on the one hand, he's saying, That if one has in the past done things unskillfully that have caused suffering to oneself or others, one should sincerely repent. What is it? Tell them to repent. So repent means, again, that one should feel a sense of contrition, a sense of wrongdoing, and be willing to acknowledge that, right? So that's kind of just good basic religious spiritual teaching. You know, have a conscience, sort of. But do not tell him to consign them to the past. If we consign things to the past, that would mean what? That they're locked away and done with. In a certain way, I think what he's inferring is just because we've acknowledged a wrongdoing in the past, it doesn't mean that those tendencies may not still be in us. So it doesn't mean you have to be constantly dwelling on them, bringing them up, inducing any type of guilt, you know, that kind of thing. But just, you know, understand what caused you to act in the way you acted at the time in the past, and keep that awareness in the present so you don't continue to create these types of offenses. Offenses meaning, quite simply, that one has acted in the way that it has either caused deliberate suffering or pain to another human being, or there are offenses where we have been unwilling to either through the form of activity or actions, words, been there to alleviate the suffering of another. Tell him to repent of former offenses, but do not tell him to consign them to the past. Tell her to use her own illness as a means of sympathizing with the illness of others, for she should understand their sufferings throughout the countless kalpas of their past existence, and should think how can she bring benefit to living beings? All right. So we're sick, right? Martina's not feeling well. Fred's got this, you know what I mean? And again, it can go either direction, right? It can go into complete self-absorption, only caring about oneself, thinking about oneself, self-pity, poor me, you know, how come everybody's not taking care of me? You know what I mean? We get typically in the psychological world, at least we call that regression, to a more infantile mind state. But be that as it is, we all know that that often happens. And so tell her to use the illness as a means to develop sympathy for the illness of others, right? So as we're laying in bed, or as, Martina's back there feeling just miserable, she thinks to herself, I'm not alone, you know. There are many, many beings, right? Throughout this realm, throughout this world, and other, you know, all over this world, who are probably suffering as much as I am physically, and many that are suffering much more so. I am suffering, but at least I am here surrounded by friends in a beautiful situation and have the means of taking care of myself, right? So many people have no access to medicine, no access to supportive environments, no access to any sympathy or help. So we use our misfortune to broaden our sense of connection and empathy to other beings in the world. It's very important. Because you know, learning that is in the body, learning that is in the emotions, learning that is felt, is often more powerful than learning that is purely intellectual. And so when we are sick, and again, you know, we can broaden that out. When we're physically sick, when we're emotionally sick, when we're going through a difficult emotional time, et cetera, et cetera. Again, rather than constricting and narrowing and just getting lost in our own storyline and make it all about me, right? One can see the broader picture. Oh, this is what it's like. This is what it's like. So I know now what it's like to have a sore knee and have difficulty walking about. What are you learning, Bill, from your illness?
I'm not suffering quite as much from trying to be perfect.
So, but what do you mean? Are you, come on.
It was a hell of a struggle.
Oh,
I never got there anyway.
So you suffered from what? So your suffering was what? You suffered from...
Foolishness.
Yeah, but it was a suffering that was from what? Because you you were dissatisfied with... Your expectations weren't being met. Dissatisfied with your performance. You were, right? Disappointed, frustrated. Right? Oh, Bill goes. So this is what it's like to be disappointed in oneself. This is what it's like. You see how we get out of it. You know, in the beginning we're just alone in it and it's just kind of gobbling us up. But the Bodhisattva steps back and goes, oh, this is what it's like to be disappointed in oneself, to be frustrated with one's performance, to not live up to expectations. Oh. So when other people talk about this, now I understand what it feels like. Right? Oh, good. In the future, I'll be much more empathic to people. I'll have a deeper understanding. Right? And if I'm able to get myself out of it, then I'll be able to really have a kind of a... It's like in medicine, you know, you'll have a subspecialty there. I can really help people who kind of have this high expectation. You know what I'm saying? Now because I... So all of a sudden, it's not that bad to suffer. Which sounds bizarre. But the Bodhisattva has the capacity of taking their misfortune and transforming it because they see the universality of it, and it just increases... their capacity for empathy and compassion. Anybody else want to? Anybody else have a good suffering that they've been suffering? Martina, what are you suffering?
I think I'm allergic to warm periods.
So.
Pain breathing from breathing in paint.
Oh. So we don't have to convince you that the body is a magnet for suffering. It seems like you can't even take a walk out your front door without... But again, you know, I was saying to somebody the other day, it's interesting in the Buddhist teachings on suffering, they say that often those things that are closest to us and our most normal part of everyday life are often the sources of suffering, right? So, right? Enjoying nature... A bug flies in your eye, right? And all of a sudden, you're rushed off to the emergency ward or something, right? You want to be helpful and you want to help them paint something. Before you know it, you're having an allergic reaction. That's it, right? What a world, eh? So Martina knows, right, that she's not alone like that, is she? Right? All kinds of people having allergic reactions, having respiratory problems, having, right? Think they're out for an enjoyable time and all of a sudden it just becomes a disaster. So she thinks like that. And it doesn't necessarily alleviate the physical suffering, but it shifts the context, doesn't it? And if we really say, oh, now I understand more personally this Buddhist teaching on impermanence. I understand more clearly how one thinks when one leaves the door, leaves one's house in the morning, right? We have our plans about how the day is going to unfold, and yet what? We really don't know, do we? Anything could happen. She should understand their sufferings throughout the countless kalpas of their past existence and should know how she can bring benefit to all beings. So when I get healthy again, right? But remember Martina, like Vimalakirti, when people came to him, remember, and inquired about his health, he also, as the sick person, was able to step back and give teachings, the same kind of teachings. So it also, remember, means, in this Vimalakirti is telling how, when we go visit a sick bodhisattva, how to talk with them. But he's also given us teachings when we're sick and people come, with their usual sympathetic inquiries. We can also step back and use our own sickness as a teaching, as an expedient means to help people see more clearly the nature of reality. Tell him to recall the good fortune he has won through religious practice, to concentrate on a life of purity and not to give way to gloom and worry. Again, because when someone is sick, they tend to be what? They get very narrow. Right? Very narrow. Tell him to recall the good fortune he has won through religious practice. Do we reflect in that way? You know, in the Anapanasati Sutta, in the meditations on the mind, in the meditation has to do with gladdening the mind. We know that one of the recommended reflections is to reflect on the good fortune that one has had to have spiritual teachings and practice come in one's life, so that one now knows how to transform their suffering. So now one knows how to train their body, speech, and mind in ways that will create meaning and fulfillment and happiness for themselves and others. Right? I mean, that's a pretty good thing. But we have topsy-turvy minds, and we're always focusing on what's wrong and what's missing and what should be. And, right? We don't stop to see what good fortune. I mean, as Americans, what good fortune we have, right? I mean, even when things are bad, we're still better than 80% of the world, at least in a material sense, comfort sense, access sense. You know, many spiritual teachers say that the the purest expression of spiritual development in a human being is a constant sense of a gratitude and appreciation. A constant sense of gratitude and appreciation. You know, which means I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful that I woke up this morning. Still breathing. I'm grateful that I have the practice of mindfulness to reveal the wonders of life. I'm grateful, Southern Dharma, I'm grateful for all of you, right? I mean, you know what I mean? Grateful. I just walk down the hill and have a delicious breakfast. Right? On and on and on, right? But our mind doesn't think this way, does it? Petty little people. Caught up in petty things. What time is my shower today? Hope there's hot water. You know, things like that. I can't believe they've run out of coffee. Quick. Gotta get some more coffee going. Like that, right? We're kind of silly, petty. Tell him to recall the good fortune he has won through religious practice. All of us here, whether we are in a good place today or in a not so good place today, we all have good fortune. We have the tools of emancipation. We have the leisure and opportunity to practice it. We have good teachers and good teaching, and we have good spiritual friends. I mean, where is it better than this, in this world? And again, we need to stop and reflect in this way, so our hearts stay happy and joyous and grateful. Worldly people get caught up in the drama. Worldly people are focusing on what's wrong, or what they need, and what they gotta get, right, to be happy. People of the path, people of the Dharma, are grateful for what they have. And see all the goodness and good fortune that has come to them. You know, when I spent in the 70s time, several years with the Tibetan refugees in India and Nepal, you know, they just, lost their homeland. They had lost their homes. They had... And many of them had lost family members, either through the fighting with the Chinese, people locked up in prison, people killed, and many people died because the when they fled over the Malayas into India and Bhutan and those Himalayan regions because they were having to flee the Chinese. Many of them weren't able to prepare for the journey the way they usually do, as well because the Chinese were hunting them. Many of the main routes and passes were inaccessible, so they had to go through many ways that were more difficult. They had arrived in a country very different than Tibet. They were plagued by all kinds of diseases and difficulties because they, having lived at such heights, they were not used to the lower regions and the heat, and just really didn't have any immune system to fight off many of the diseases. So it was a disaster for them. And yet, they had this incredible capacity. And again, I don't want to make them seem other than normal. It's not that they don't have difficulties and sadnesses and all that. But I was amazed at their incredible resiliency and their capacity for understanding and for happiness. I mean, they had a great capacity to be happy. They were not full of resentment. They were not full of anger. They were not overwhelmed. That's not to say that some weren't, you know what I'm saying? I don't want to glorify things. But it was I was quite struck by that. And where did that come from? That came from Dharma. Because what you find it's interesting, what you find in a lot of the Asian countries is you find many of the, quote-unquote, ordinary people, lay people, don't really know a lot about Buddhism. I mean, most of us here, if we were in Asia, we would be considered, highly learned Buddhists, right? Because most of us have read so many authentic Buddhist texts and teachings, and we've taken teachings, so we if we went to Asia, we would be very unusual lay people. Most of the lay people in Asia, their practice isn't like that at all. And yet the interesting thing is so many of the practices have just entered the culture. The people don't, so they live it without even, without even knowing that it's, that the rest of us are trying to practice it to get there. And again, I don't want to glorify that. It's not they're all kinds of stuff. But it's just very interesting. Because the first things the Tibetans would do when they would settle themselves, they would start practicing. And wherever they were, with their even the common people, with their mala beads and with their prayer wheels. Many of them had to work in the early days. They worked on road gangs. They were up in the mountains, and the Indians needed people to help build roads in these high areas. And there was a time, a little later, with the Chinese. So anyhow, Tibetans had great ability to withstand these colder, higher regions. So a lot of them, very difficult work, working on these road crews, living in a difficult situation, and yet always practicing, and always grateful that even though they had lost their homeland and many of their loved ones, they still had Dharma. They still knew how to transform their suffering. They still knew how to transform their anger. They still knew how to have the capacity to love and to be compassionate. So we should reflect on that. Tell him to recall the good fortune he has won through religious practice. concentrate on a life of purity, not to give way to gloom or worry. So we have to ask ourselves, is that what I'm doing? Am I concentrating on living a life of purity? And what am I concentrating on every day? And purity here doesn't mean, you know, purity means pure intention, selfless intention, altruistic living. So, you know, for those of you who hear purity and you're perfectionists right away go to creating a standard to yourself and then you beat yourselves up for not, you know, please don't go there. Okay, Bill?
I'll try.
Oh. Good. Purity is not your thing. Yeah.
That's lost.
Good. To concentrate on a life of purity, which means what? I mean, you know, again, from Buddhist perspective, the Mahayana Bodhisattva means, you know, can I maintain a pure intention to today, right? To not create suffering for myself or others. To be kind, to be helpful, right? To not run my day based solely on my own egoistic concerns, but to be attentive and helpful to others. Right? Am I concentrating on pure intention today, purity of life? Most of us don't wake up that way, do we? Most of us, as we go through our day, are not generating that type of intention. Do not have that. That's not what we're concentrating on. The Bodhisattva, that's what they're concentrating on. Now, they may be going through their day, you know, going to work, shopping, running errands, you know, doing whatever we do. But what they're concentrating on is how can I today live a life of purity? A life of purity means not being stained by egoism. Not living a life of attachment, grasping at things, pushing things away, manipulating things, focused on just getting my needs, my wants met. Alleviating the suffering of the world, not contributing to it, right? Bringing clarity where there's confusion, not contributing to the confusion. So again, as you can see, the Bodhisattva way is not a physical path. It is really a mind path. But to really walk it, we have to really be clear about these intentions. To concentrate on a life of purity and not to give way to gloom or worry. So the Bodhisattva should never give way to gloom or worry. Interesting, right? So that gloom and worry, we can call that in our modern parlance, a depression and anxiety. Which is what? Which is epidemic in our society, right? I mean, it's considered normal, right? I'm really down about this. I'm really anxious about that, you know. Gloom and worry, depression and anxiety. Right? The twin pillars of modern modern psychology, psychiatry, and pharmaceutical industry. I'm not belittling it, because I know there are many of us here who have difficulties with anxiety and depression. And certainly as either acute episodes or as an ongoing mental state, there is much suffering involved. Even though I'm being a little humorous, I understand the significance of these mind states. So 2,500 years ago, do not give way to depression and anxiety, Vimalakirti says. So it was known then. Depression and anxiety were known then. Again, you know, there are lots of ways to look at this, and lots of ways we can talk about this. If you think about If one, like we're talking about here, if one is a bodhisattva, right? And if one is taking as one's job, one's primary career in life, to develop deeper understanding, deeper wisdom, deeper insight, deeper compassion, deeper open-heartedness, deeper kindness, patience, right? I mean, if that is the object in one's life, right? Then no matter what the external circumstances of one's life is, the opportunity is always there to cultivate those, right? If things go well or if things don't go well. If things turn out the way we want or things don't turn out the way we want, right? It's not about how things are working in the external world. The bodhisattva is not attached to that. Right, Carol? The bodhisattva is not grasping at phenomena. Phenomena is anything and everything that appears to any of the senses and the mind. We are not grasping at any of that. We are always doing our best to be mindful, to be present, to be concentrated, and to look deeply at what's going on. We're always cultivating compassion, loving kindness, you know, the six paramitas, etc., the right views, that's what we're doing. So if that's what we're doing, you know, if you think about depression and anxiety, depression is usually is over-concern and view about the past. And anxiety is always about the future. We're not worried about what happened in the past. Try to worry about what happened in the past. You can't do it. You can only worry about what's going to happen. So worry is always future-based. And usually depression is about the way we're looking at the past and the way our life has happened and what's happened and things that have happened to us or things that we should have done or didn't do. You know what I mean? It's so... That's where the mind is traveling. And when the mind travels down those roads and they are negative, that space of the mind fills up with what we call depression or what we call anxiety. And it only comes because we are, I'll say it for Carol, we are grasping at phenomena. Stories of the past, fantasies about the future, that's all they are. How can I say that? Because we all know what? The past is past. It does not exist. The future is a fantasy. It does not exist. It only exists as a concept, a memory that's arising in your mind. And how solid is that? Thought, feeling, perception that's arising in your mind. Like a bubble, like a lightning in the dark, like an echo, like a firefly, just like that. Right? That's all it is. But if you see it as something solid, something real, and you grasp at it, and you embroider it, and make a story, and cling to it, and hold it, and then carry it around with you. We carry it around. Got my depression on this side, got my anxiety on this side, got my past on this side, got my future on this side. No wonder our knees hurt. Wonder we feel burdened. You know, we're not our feeling of oppression and burdened and weighed down is not a delusion, my friends. You are weighed down. So when you go to your sick bodhisattva friend, remind her of the good fortune she has won through her meditation, spiritual, religious practice. Tell him or her to concentrate on a life of purity and not give way to gloom and worry. Because when you give way to gloom and worry, it is very difficult to carry on your bodhisattva work. Because you are now burdened. And you are now lost in your own self-absorption. Because if you think about it, so much of your rumination of the past and so much of your worry about the future is I-based, self-based. You are involved, we are involved with our story. And that is the central story that we are concerned about. We're not concerned about others. Right? Martina now, she came in here totally absorbed in her own misery, and now she goes, but I'm sitting in a room full of miserable people. She's feeling better. She's feeling a lot better. Right? We could talk, people will be sharing their stories about the bugs that flew in their eyes and their allergic reactions, right? I mean, right? If it's not our story, it's somebody we know, right? I mean, we all, because we all share this together. But when we're in that place of depression, when we're in that place of anxiety, when we're in that place of worry and gloom, it is a very self-absorbed bubble that we have found ourselves in. And the longer we stay in it, and the more attached we are to it, the deeper and thicker it becomes. Right? And oftentimes it becomes quite difficult to find our way out of it. And we often need help to do it. So, Vimalakirti says, tell them, do not give way to gloom or worry. Whatever happens, you have the tools to deal with it. Right. So if somebody says, well, what happens if we run out of energy? Right? What happens if global warming is true and the world is heating up and there's all these ecological disasters and change and difficulty, you know? What's going to happen? And your answer would be, whatever happens, my intention is to be of help, because those will be difficult times and people will need somebody to care for them, to help them. That's all. Could it be as simple as that? We're here to help. We're not here to feather our nest. So that's your answer, Seal says. What happens if the world comes to an end? Worlds have come to the end in the past. Everything has to end at some point, doesn't it? It'd be a shame. It's a beautiful world, isn't it? But maybe it was just given to the wrong species. Did not have the maturity to take care of it. Could be like that. We should cultivate constant vigilance, striving to become a king of physicians who can lead, who can heal the ailments of the assembly. This is how a bodhisattva should comfort and instruct another bodhisattva who is ill, so as to make him or her feel happy. I know I encounter people, I know sometimes people here that come from other religious traditions or Buddhist traditions, and don't feel, wonder about words like happy. I think Buddhist practice is about being serious. Buddhist practice is about being, I don't know, what?
Stern.
Stern. Serious, stern, somber, solemn. And they go happy. Comfort and instruct the bodhisattva is ill to, so as to make him or her feel happy. So these are wonderful instructions. So next time you are called to inquire, one of your bodhisattva friends is ill, you know how to talk with him. So they can be happy. And again, our diligence, cultivate constant diligence, working hard to become a king of physicians who could heal the elements of the assembly. So you know that the Buddha, one of his epithets was the great physician. He was able to assess and diagnose and treat all the ailments that cause sentient beings to suffer. So therefore he was like a doctor. But a doctor who saw the deeper etiology of disease. And therefore his prescriptions were not just only giving temporary relief. He knew how to prescribe antidotes that created well-being. He didn't just cure the symptoms. So that is our aspiration, right? To be a groupie king. King of physicians. And again, you know, in Buddhism, especially in the Mahayana, the great vehicle, we are allowed this type of grandiosity. It is not considered pathological to have this aspiration. A king of physicians, it means not that we go around lording it over all the other physicians. It's not like that. It really means being the greatest of physicians. Why is the greatest of physicians? Because he or she is just so skillful. So skillful in their capacity to help. So we will stop here. Thank you, Vimalakirti. So we will be ending now. We'll rise, and then 5 minutes, Sam will ring the bell, and we will meet up.